The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, don't forget to send those messages to td@kpcg.fm. Well, they're building some big barriers around the Democratic Convention coming up tonight in Philadelphia. They've got to do that to protect those attending that convention. No need for barriers at the borders, however. That's been the policy of the U.S. government for now, decades. And yet you can see why there are so many people who are rallying around a candidate that really is flawed in a lot of ways, but that insists he's going to build a barrier, that he's going to build a wall. We'll talk more as we proceed about the convention coming up there in Philadelphia. We'll also look at the terrorist attacks in Germany. There have been quite a few, in case you haven't noticed. There's lots of news and stories on politics in the U.S., of course. But hopefully you've been keeping a watch on Germany as well. What can these attacks mean? Where is it leading? We'll be looking at that. And then, as I say, we'll be looking at not just the Democratic Convention, but the Democratic Party in America. The latest WikiLeaks revelations has the party scrambling right here on the eve of its convention. And of course, speaking of conventions, we'll also be revisiting last week's Republican convention in Cleveland, specifically Donald Trump's speech that he gave last Thursday night, and in particular as it compares to Ronald Reagan's speech at the Republican convention in 1980. Some have compared Mr. Trump to Ronald Reagan. And so we'll look at these two speeches and let you compare and contrast the two. First, though, we'll begin with these attacks in Germany. Yesterday, two more. Again, these are small-scale attacks compared to the one like in Nice a couple of weeks ago. But here you had the attack in front of this bar at the center of a Bavarian town, Ansbach, I think is the name of it. He had a suicide bomb on. He didn't get inside the bar, and I guess it blew up afterwards, or after he left, and it ended up killing him and no one else, but I think 12 people were injured, 3 seriously. And then yesterday also, there was the machete attack on this pregnant woman in the street, again, injuring several other people as well. So if you're counting, that's 4 terrorist attacks in Germany over the past week. Just over the past week. And 2 of them carried out by Syrian refugees. And then, of course, the axe-wielding attack we drew attention to last week on this program, the hacking attack on that passenger train. And that attacker had pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. And then, of course, you had the attack Friday night that made huge headlines here in Europe, here in the U.K., down in Munich, the shooting at the mall and at McDonald's. And now this one evidently was not an Islamist, but he was an Iranian German who had been planning this attack for some time. And some authorities say that he had an Afghan accomplice. So you put all of this together with the Nice attack, and in that case it was another self-confessed Islamist, this Tunisian who was aided by at least 4 accomplices. He had made as many as 12 different trips to that Nice seafront in his lorry or his truck before the massacre, so he had been planning it for some time. This was a carefully orchestrated Islamic attack. More and more of these are. Some are more random. But still, where's this leading? What's building? Now in Germany, 4 in the last week. Deutsche Welle says here, after Munich, politicians consider deploying soldiers at home. I mean, this marks a pretty significant departure from, just the post-war policies in Germany, particularly with respect to its army. Deutsche Welle says, in remarks published in the Welt am Sonntag newspaper Sunday, Bavarian Interior Minister Joachim Herrmann advocated for the army to be allowed to deploy within Germany to support the police in case of a terror attack. Now notice this, Germany's constitution, drawn up in the aftermath of World War II, places strict limits on the use of the military, the Bundeswehr, within the country's borders. Those regulations are now obsolete, Herrmann said. It quotes him saying, we have an absolutely stable democracy in our country. It would be completely incomprehensible if we had a terrorist situation like Brussels in Frankfurt, Stuttgart, or Munich, and we were not permitted to call in the well-trained forces of the Bundeswehr, even though they stand ready. And he made these comments, by the way, even before the attack in Munich Friday night. This was last week when he made these remarks after that axe attack on the train. And he's saying, look, we need to put our army in the streets if need be. It's happening in France. It could be happening in Germany next. And again, you can hardly fault the government or fault individuals like this for suggesting it. But going back to Germany's constitution, drawn up in the aftermath of World War II, the strict limits put upon the military, these limitations are now being removed, or at least they're being called on for removal. These are some pretty dramatic developments. And it's brought on because of this constant pushing coming from the King of the South, radical Islam. Push and push and push. Just like the Bible says in Daniel 11:40. And the King of the North is stirring. There's a sleeping giant that's awakening in Germany. 4 attacks in 1 week. Now, of course, there are those particularly who defend Ms. Merkel's administration, saying that, well, they're just lone wolves, or, well, this wasn't coordinated. It wasn't a radical Islamist. But still, just the fact that 2 of them were Syrian refugees. 2 were Syrian refugees. What do you think the German people are thinking about the refugee crisis? The Telegraph, there's an opinion piece here just today or yesterday. It says Angela Merkel's open door has left her fighting for survival. How about that for a headline? German politics is a tinderbox waiting to explode. Berlin let out a sigh of relief that the Munich killer had no link to Islamic terrorists. Think about that. They're sitting there, they're watching this atrocity play out on TV like we are, and then they breathe a collective sigh of relief. Well, at least he's not a radical Islamist. At least there's no link to Islamic terrorists, because they know. They know what this would bring about. They know the kind of reaction that the general populace would have. It says here, but whatever his motives, a political thunderstorm is brewing over the country's immigration and refugee policies. The Telegraph says here, a deep collective angst has taken Germany over ever since Angela Merkel decided to open the borders to over 1 million refugees last summer. The fervent optimism of the refugees' welcome movement has long since faded. And now people are scared. That's right, it was just about a year ago, maybe a little over a year ago. All of the fervent optimism. Refugees welcome! At some train stations, there were Germans there welcoming them with open arms. Well, that has since disappeared. Because now people are scared. Now there's an attack in Munich. Now there's an attack in other Bavarian cities. Ansbach, and elsewhere. Now there's an attack on a train. And these are coming from refugees. Or in the case of Munich, it's coming from a German citizen of Iranian descent. Telegraph says here, though Germany has been relatively unscathed from jihadist terrorism, the sex assaults in Cologne on New Year's Eve, combined with the horrors of Paris, Brussels, and Nice, have entrenched an awful sense of foreboding. More than three-quarters of Germans believed a terrorist attack was imminent, according to a poll last week by national broadcaster ZDF. Think on that. Three-quarters. They saw what happened in Cologne, and then the horror in Paris, and in Brussels, and in Nice, and they know it's coming. They know it's coming. This opinion piece says here, and it makes sense, the scale of change in Germany is unprecedented, and nobody really knows how to talk about it. Net immigration increased by 49% to over 2 million in 2015. And it says, for the first time in Germany's history, most of the new arrivals are not European. About half are refugees from outside the continent. I mean, these figures represent dramatic shifts and changes in demographics. Net immigration increased by 49% in just 2015. And, of course, the big difference with that year and any year before is they're not European, these refugees. They're coming from Syria and other places like that. It says legitimate fears over integration, social cohesion, and the sheer pace of change have been brushed under the carpet. And so, as this author brings out, it's just a tinderbox waiting to explode. It's waiting to explode. And you have politicians now, even after a massive attack, breathing a sigh of relief. Well, at least there were no connections to radical Islam. That's the state in Germany today. That's the way it is in Germany today. How much longer? How much longer does Angela Merkel have before she's out and someone else comes in? And what about the strong man prophesied in Daniel 8? All this, as we've been covering recently, this is just going to accelerate the fulfillment of these prophecies. Daniel 8, Daniel 11. I mean, you see the early stages of the clash. You certainly see the pushing. It's happening, and as I say, with so much happening in the United States, so many problems, so much division, and of course so much politics making headlines, this is not something we want to overlook, what's happening in Europe and what's happening in Germany. Well, the Democratic Party is now in disarray. There were Democrats, of course, last week talking about how divided and upside down the Republican Party was last week. And then you have the release of these emails. And now the Democratic Party is scrambling. This is from today's New York Times. Democrats arrived at their nominating convention on Sunday under a cloud of discord as Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee, abruptly said she was resigning after a trove of leaked emails showed party officials conspiring to sabotage the campaign of Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. And, of course, Donald Trump has been out there talking about how the system is rigged against Sanders. Sanders himself has said this, and now the emails evidently confirm it. And so you're going to have a big split, a big division in the Democratic side now. It says the revelation, along with sizable pro-Sanders protests here in the streets to greet arriving delegates, threatened to undermine the delicate healing process that followed the contentious fight between Mr. Sanders and Hillary Clinton. There were quite a few of those commentators suggested there might be violence surrounding the Republican convention. Well, who knows what might happen with this one as they're building this this security barrier to surround a convention, of all things, in Philadelphia for the Democrats. It says it raised the prospect, this is the New York Times, that a convention that was intended to showcase the Democratic Party's optimism and unity in contrast to the Republicans could be marred by dissension and disorder. The day also veered extraordinarily into allegations not easily dismissed that Russia had a hand in the leaks that helped bring down the head of an American political party. And so Russia might have been behind the WikiLeaks release, bringing down Wasserman Schultz. It says later down in the piece, the breach of the Democratic Committee's emails, another email scandal for Mrs. Clinton. Pretty amazing. offered undeniable evidence of what Mr. Sanders' supporters had complained about for much of the senator's contentious primary contest with Mrs. Clinton, that the party was effectively an arm of Mrs. Clinton's campaign. They wanted her in from the beginning. And so even though Sanders went out there and got a lot of popular support, particularly among young people, which says a lot about the system of education in the United States, that an avowed socialist would get so much support from young people, from graduates of college, university. In any event, it was too much to go against this arm, this massive arm, the Democratic Party that Clinton had in her back pocket right at the outset of this race. And yet, even though she's got the system, as rigged as it might be, in her back pocket, you can still see the influence of education today and just the popular support behind Bernie Sanders, and just how radical the swing has been to the left within the Democratic Party in the last generation or so. This piece here in the Wall Street Journal, Clinton won the battle, but Sanders won the war. I mean, this came out before the email scandal. It says Bernie Sanders and his activist supporters have moved Mrs. Clinton and the party's platform to the left. Notice some of the stats this piece gives. The result is that the Democrats have taken on an identity that comes from a new base, voters under 40, who have no problem with Mr. Sanders' socialist vision. And then it goes on and gives some stats from Pew Research. It found that 51% of millennials identify as Democrats or lean Democratic, compared with only 35% for Republicans. This is Juan Williams writing at the Wall Street Journal. This is not your father's or even your older sister's Democratic Party. It's far more left-leaning than under Bill Clinton or President Obama. I mean, how much farther left can you go from President Obama? It says almost 60% of Democratic voters agree that socialism has a positive impact on society. 60%! They think this is the way to go. They think it has a positive impact on society. And then William says here at the end, history will record this week's convention as a coming of age for a new era of liberal Democratic politics. This is now Bernie Sanders' party. Other Democrats, including Hillary Clinton, are merely living in it. And the parts I skipped over here, it just shows how that she's basically caved in to a lot of Bernie Sanders' policies just so that she can keep the support of the radical left within the radical left party. The more radical left, you could say. And so she's having to latch on to some of the socialist policies that Sanders was out there proclaiming proudly. And generating a lot of support for. It's Sanders' party, that ideology. It's now come into the center of the party. It's mainstream in that party. Now, you've got to go back and read my father's lengthy piece, his lengthy feature in the January 2016 Trumpet, The Roots of America's Dangerous Turn Left. Lots of important history discussed in that article. And pictured within that article, by the way, is a shot of Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and Bernie Sanders. All of the stars of this dangerous turn left, the new Democratic Party. My father said in his piece, few people realize it, but many mainstream political views in America today are identical to and traced directly back to the ideals and beliefs of communism. And in that article from January, the January Trumpet, he shows how that Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, among other things, I mean, he was writing about so much of this back in the 1950s and 60s. Says, this is quoting Mr. Armstrong, 1962, the Communist Party is merely a trick term to pull the wool over our eyes and to deceive us, a means of getting a fifth column into our midst, of getting the enemy's government into our very midst, leading us to accept it as part of our government. its only object is to destroy our government. Now, you look at so many of the policies and just the level of destruction that we now see in America's cities, for example, and so many of America's founding institutions. I mean, the whole system. You want to talk about the system being rigged. It's all coming down. It's all crashing down. And it's because of the foothold that this movement has had in education now for two generations at least. Mr. Armstrong wrote, this again is from a Plain Truth article, actually the Communist Party, and again I'll leave it for you to read the article by my father where he talks about the close link between socialism and communism. I won't get into all of the, it's a long piece as I say, but quoting Mr. Armstrong, it talks about this communist ideology being a ruthless totalitarian dictatorship. It's run with absolute power by a few men at the top, all of whom are completely subservient to one man who's a dictator absolute. This one-man dictatorship is supposed to be necessary because there are many different interpretations of the Marxist philosophy. Therefore, to prevent division, they must have a supreme interpreter. There has to be this supreme one at the top. And my father in the article talks about where it's leading. It's not like it's just the fault of the government or the leader at the top. Ezekiel 7 speaks of the chain of violent crimes in our land and how that God points out there in that passage that it's because of the sins of the people. There's no political candidate who, as we'll get into here in the second segment, who's going to make America great again, no matter what people might think. Of course. I mean, I'm an American. Who wouldn't want to see America great again? You know, you'll hear some clips from Ronald Reagan's speech back in 1980, and it's emotional to hear it. And you do hear that and say, well, what could we do to bounce back like we did in 1980, to bounce back like we did throughout the 1980s after a dreadful administration? There at the last bit of the 1970s. Well, as I say, we'll get into that further in the second segment, this comparison in particular between Ronald Reagan and one today who is out there repeatedly saying, we're going to make America great again. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the Literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
The Trumpet Daily.
This past weekend on our television program here in the UK, we played the program, He Was Right. If you remember, a few weeks back before Brexit, we produced a program that talked about the upcoming vote. That was a show, as it turns out, that the stations over here did not approve, so it didn't make it to the air before Brexit. But now that news of that historic vote has died down a little bit, we went back and talked about that more from a historical standpoint now, of course, and then tied in what Mr. Armstrong said right there, even in that booklet that we've put together with all of those quotes from The Plain Truth. He was right. So that program ran over the weekend here. It's on thetrumpet.com right now if you'd like to view the program. In any event, it generated 211 requests, so we have now another program that brought in over 200 requests for literature. In this case, the beautiful He Was Right booklet, 70, 80 pages, I believe, of that magazine-sized booklet that pulls together all of the highlights of the many prophecies that Mr. Armstrong drew attention to over the course of his 50-plus year ministry. Well, a few more stats here also regarding the radio program. You might have noticed if you clicked on the program from Friday, the title there had a quote from Donald Trump that said, "Nobody knows the system better than me, which is why I alone can fix it." We'll come back to that quote later on, by the way. In any event, that particular episode now has over 1,600 plays on SoundCloud, so it very quickly became one of our most listened to programs for the month of July. And speaking of July, right now we're on a pace to outperform June. June, as you recall, was our best month on SoundCloud with, I think it was 31,500 plays on SoundCloud. And I think right now we're on pace to perhaps get up as high as 33,000. So another 1,500 or so increase on the SoundCloud plays for the month of July. Of course, we've still got about a week left in this month, so we'll see how the listening goes over the next several days, and we'll certainly give you some stats at the end of this month, or rather at the start of August, to let you know how we did for the month of July. Well, since it's been 4 days now, there have been quite a few commentators and journalists that have weighed in on Donald Trump's speech from last week, and of course many in the media pointed out how that in their view this was a very dark message. The New York Times says his tone dark. Donald Trump takes GOP mantle. The Washington Post said Donald Trump's dark speech to the Republican National Convention, that's I guess the operative word, dark. CBS News: Donald Trump offers dark vision of America in GOP convention speech. The Telegraph, not just in the States, the Telegraph here in the UK: Donald Trump paints dark vision of America. Of course, there were other voices farther to the left that said, oh, this speech scared me. It was scary. It gave me chills. I mean, not for good reasons. Now, the Trump backers, of course, they heard a very different speech. And a lot of them, as you heard even at the convention itself, they thought it was great. They thought it was awesome. They didn't see any concerns in what he said. From the American Thinker today, it says, "Memories of Ronald Reagan's Morning in America, simple, refreshing, and optimistic." This is this guy's take on the speech that Trump gave on Thursday night. "Projecting confidence and giving voters hope, big media simply reinforces its bias and tone deafness in calling Trump's words dark in the face of most Americans hearing the same words as optimism." It cites a study that indicates that many of Americans viewing it thought it was a pretty positive speech. And this writer at the American Thinker refers or compares it to the memories of Morning in America. That's the campaign slogan, or not the slogan, but it was a commercial actually that President Reagan put together for his campaign in 1984. This is 4 years after he was in office running against Walter Mondale, and of course the country had turned around significantly by that point, and Reagan decided, rather than, you know, really going after his opponent, that he would just keep his campaign very positive, very upbeat. And this commercial sort of encapsulated that. It was just a positive, upbeat commercial, 30 seconds or so, that basically asked, well, why would you want to go back to the way it was 4 years ago? Look at the direction we're headed in. And Reagan, as we know, won in a landslide against Walter Mondale. That was back in 1984. So you have these comparisons being made. The American Thinker did this morning. Newsmax a while back talked about how Reagan and Trump were both, or are both, in the case of Trump, Washington outsiders. Newsmax had quite a list of comparisons. Reagan was dismissed as a serious candidate. And, of course, last year at this time, so was Trump. There were quite a few Republicans running for the nomination that just couldn't even wrap their minds around the fact that it could be Trump. They scoffed at it 8-9 months ago, even as recently as 5-6 months ago. It can't happen. There's no way it can happen. Newsmax says Trump and Reagan were both attacked by the establishment for being supposedly too extreme or on the other hand, too simplistic. Trump was a Democrat before becoming a Republican. Now, his conversion was much more recent than Reagan's. In any event, they say, well, they were both liberals before they became Republicans. And then for those that criticize Trump, saying, well, he was a reality star, he was into television, he was into this, they say, well, Reagan was into movies, Reagan was an actor. Again, long before he became a politician. In any event, comparisons like this are being made and continue to be made. This is this first clip that I'll play for you here is from the now vice presidential candidate, Mike Pence. This is the one that Donald Trump selected to run with him. And this is what he said a couple of weeks ago, or I guess it was just about a week ago, about Donald Trump.
To be around our nominee, as I had the privilege to be, not on the campaign trail, but out among his associates, people that he's employed for years, and among his family. I have a sense of this man. I have a sense of his heart. I have a sense of his hands-on style of leadership. And for all the world, he reminds me of Ronald Reagan.
So that's Mike Pence speaking of Donald Trump, saying that Trump reminds him of Ronald Reagan. Now, Pence comes from the conservative wing of the party, that wing that's pretty much been left out. Certainly those that support Ted Cruz. And as I recall, I think Mike Pence even endorsed Ted Cruz when he came through Indiana during the primaries. But now things have changed, and now he's the vice presidential candidate, and he says Donald Trump is the heir of Reagan. And as I say, he's not alone. If you look at Newsmax and some of the others. So I thought what would be interesting is to just compare and contrast some of the statements made last week in Trump's speech compared to what Mr. Reagan said back in 1980. Their convention in 1980, by the way, was in Detroit. And we'll start. I want to play a few again. Some of this we played on Friday from Mr. Trump's message. But let's start with something that Ronald Reagan said at that party nomination. This is July 17th, 1980. Clip 2.
For those who've abandoned hope, we'll restore hope and we'll welcome them into a great national crusade to make America great again.
A national crusade to make America great again. That last part of the comment, of course, has been made popular today by Mr. Trump.
And we will make America great again.
Make America great again. That's been the slogan from the beginning, and one that Mr. Reagan used repeatedly. So this is a slogan that Trump himself has taken from Mr. Reagan and has used over and over again, and of course it's mutated into a lot of other statements, as you heard on the convention floor last week. Make America safe again, make America strong again, make America proud again, all of these things. And then this one, too, from last week, clip 4.
I have made billions of dollars in business-making deals. Now I'm going to make our country rich again.
Now, before we even get to some of the clips from Reagan, I think just picking up on some of the ways that he expresses himself and the tone, you know, how much I've made, the billions and billions of dollars, and how that I'm going to make our country rich again. Just kind of keep note of that in your mind as you prepare to listen to those statements from Mr. Reagan from 1980. Here's another one from last Thursday. This is clip 5.
As your president, I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens from the violence and oppression of a hateful foreign ideology. Believe me. And I have to say, as a Republican, it is so nice to hear you cheering for what I just said. Thank you.
As a Republican, I couldn't be happier. It's so nice to hear you cheer for my promise to protect the LGBTQ. We got into the Q thing on Friday. In case that's new to you, you can Google it. But it's so nice because, well, Republicans haven't always been so nice to this community. It's just exciting to hear the cheers coming from you. Thank you for that. That's what he was saying on Thursday night. Notice what else he had to say, clip 6.
And I am not going to let companies move to other countries, firing their employees along the way without consequence. Not going to happen anymore.
Now, that's an astounding statement, really, that as President of the United States, you've got the three branches of government, and in his office, should he be voted there, he is not going to let companies move to other countries. If a United States company decided it didn't want to have its headquarters in Nebraska and wanted to move to some other nation instead, he is going to stop it. It's not going to happen anymore. Those are his direct words. As I say, in a land of freedom, it's hard to imagine someone coming into office with that kind of a vow. I mean, to say that I'll offer incentives for companies to stay is one thing, but it's not going to happen. I'm not going to let companies move. That's amazing. This next clip here, we played this on Friday for you about, and I quoted it earlier, about he is the only one that can fix the problem. This is clip 7.
Nobody knows the system better than me. Which is why I alone can fix it.
Now, we're comparing some of the audio tracks. If you were to see, and if you had the time, it might be worth doing, just comparing the video of both these speeches. Because if you look at him when he made that particular statement, that yes, I'm in on it, I'm part of the rigged system, and I'm the only one that can fix it, and the smirk, and just the arrogance. And you compare that with Mr. Reagan's demeanor in that speech from 1980. There are similarities, to be sure. Both individuals fighting for the nomination and then hoping to be the president, following after just a disastrous administration that's undermined the power and the influence of the United States worldwide. And that's contributed to so many problems here at home. But going back to the point I made Friday, it was brief. We can maybe flesh it out a little bit more here. But just the arrogance that I alone can fix this problem. Before Mr. Trump even spoke on Thursday, he was introduced by his daughter, who said that once Donald Trump is elected president, all things will be possible again. I mean, these are the kinds of statements we've grown accustomed to hearing during presidential campaigns. Back in 2008, Joe Biden, he was running for president at the time. Of course, he later became vice president. But he said in exchange with a reporter, "My party has the chance to nominate someone to save the world." Literally, save the world. The direction this world is going is in an absolute disaster. Disaster! And 4 more years of this may be irreversible. Well, the reporter promptly asked him then, "Are you saying Joe Biden can save the world?" "Yes, yes, I am," was his response. "Of course. Of course I can save the world." And you know all about what was said regarding Barack Obama and what he himself said. That history would mark his election as president as the moment our, quote, planet began to heal and the rise of the oceans began to slow. All the problems of this world saved, solved rather. The world saved by these politicians. Of course, there were many in the media and in America that viewed Barack Obama as a messiah-like figure, a savior. Now, I'll leave it to you to go through Isaiah 2. If we went through it, I don't think we'd have much time for some of these other clips. But it says, it talks over there in that chapter about the loftiness of man, the haughtiness of men, and how that God's going to bring it down low, and how that God alone, that's the exact words in Isaiah 2, God alone shall be exalted. You contrast that. We're making comparisons. Contrast that with what we heard Thursday night. I alone can fix it. I am the solution. There were also chants Thursday night of yes, you will. You compare that to Barack Obama's crowds in 2008. Yes, we can. And now here we are 8 years further along. And you had people in the convention center the other night chanting, "Yes, you will. You will do it. He alone is able to fix it." And so the supporters have rallied around their man, seeing him as the solution to all of our problems. Now, let me take you back to what Ronald Reagan said back in July of 1980. Here are just a few of the highlights from that speech, him accepting his party's nomination that night. And, of course, he went on to win the presidential election against Jimmy Carter later on that year. This is clip number 8.
More than anything else, I want my candidacy to unify our country, to renew the American spirit and sense of purpose. I want to carry our message to every American, regardless of party affiliation, who is a member of this community of shared values.
So he wanted to bring about unity in the country. And then, again, he's coming on the scene after a disastrous 4 years, and he does have some strong things to say about Carter's administration. This one in particular about how that President Carter came in 1976 really trying to get people to look to him. This is what Reagan said regarding that. Clip 9.
We need a rebirth of the American tradition of leadership at every level of government and in private life as well. The United States of America is unique in world history because it has a genius for leaders, many leaders on many levels. But back in 1976, Mr. Carter said, "Trust me." And a lot of people did. And now many of those people are out of work. Many have seen their savings eaten away by inflation. Many others on fixed incomes, especially the elderly, have watched helplessly as the cruel tax of inflation wasted away their purchasing power. And today, a great many who trusted Mr. Carter wonder if we can survive the Carter policies of national defense. Trust Me Government asks that we concentrate our hopes and dreams on one man, that we trust him to do what's best for us. Well, my view of government places trust not in one person or one party, but in those values that transcend persons and parties.
So it's not about one person or party. but these values. And then earlier on, as you heard there, he talked about many leaders on many levels. And throughout his speech, you can go and find the transcript of it and just read it for yourself like I did this morning. But what he's talking about is for everyone to step up, for everyone to get back to those traditional American values. And he, to back this up, he goes into some pretty amazing history. This is history of America, even before America became a nation. This is clip number 10.
360 years ago in 1620, a group of families dared to cross a mighty ocean to build a future for themselves in a new world. When they arrived at Plymouth, Massachusetts, they formed what they called a compact, an agreement among themselves to build a community and abide by its laws. This single act, the voluntary binding together of free people to live under the law, set the pattern for what was to come. A century and a half later, the descendants of those people pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to found this nation. Some forfeited their fortunes and their lives. None sacrificed honor.
It's a glorious history that many Americans were once proud of, and history that you don't often hear discussed in so many of the political speeches of today. But a compact. Think about these Americans coming together. A compact, drawing up an agreement to build a community, to abide by its laws, the rule of law, and how that was the pattern. The pattern was established there for what was to come. Well, following on some of this history, then Mr. Reagan went on to talk about the new beginning that the United States had now in 1980 and the pledge that we need to make as an American people. This is clip 11.
Let us pledge to restore in our time the American spirit of voluntary service, of cooperation, of private and community initiative, a spirit that flows like a deep and mighty river through the history of our nation.
We've got to restore what's been lost. We've got to pledge together in this. And when you look at the record of the previous administration, and we'll look at this here in a second, and again, President Reagan was pretty critical here, but he was also respectful in doing it. He could have singled out Mr. Carter specifically, but instead he referred to the Carter administration and the record of this administration and the direction that this country was headed in as a result of this administration. This is what he said in 1980. Again, clip number 12.
Can anyone look at the record of this administration and say, well done? Can anyone compare the state of our economy when the Carter administration took office with where we are today and say, keep up the good work? Can anyone look at our reduced standing in the world today and say, let's have four more years of this? I believe the American people are going to answer these questions as you've answered them in the first week in November, and their answer will be, no, we've had enough. Then it will be up to us, beginning next January 20th, to offer an administration and congressional leadership of competence and more than a little courage.
Then it will be up to us collectively, this administration, congressional leadership, all of us have to be competent. All of us have to be courageous. Well, later on in the speech, I might have to skip a couple of clips here. But he talked here. Well, let me just hurriedly play clip 13.
We're not a warlike people. Quite the opposite. We always seek to live in peace. We resort to force infrequently and with great reluctance and only after we've determined that it's absolutely necessary. We are awed, and rightly so, by the forces of destruction that loosen the world in this nuclear era. But neither can we be naive or foolish. Four times in my lifetime, America has gone to war, bleeding the lives of its young men into the sands of island beachheads, the fields of Europe, and the jungles and rice paddies of Asia. We know only too well that war comes not when the forces of freedom are strong. It is when they are weak that tyrants are tempted.
And so thus began just a massive buildup of America's army, of America's military. America came back for a brief moment. The Soviet Union collapsed. So many other things happened there in the 1980s as well. But he says there that these tyrants, if we're weak, that's when they are tempted. Once America is weak, that's when the dictators and the tyrants roundabout are tempted to act. And that's what we're seeing happen today. That's what was happening in the late 70s as well. Well, let me just skip ahead to the end here. This is as he wraps up his speech and he brings God into it and the blessings that God had brought upon this great land of America. This is clip 15.
It's impossible to capture in words the splendor of this vast continent which God has granted as our portion of his creation. There are no words to express the extraordinary strength and character of this breed of people we call American.
He's talking there about the thousands of miles that he traveled during the campaign and just the beauty and the splendor of the United States. This land that God had granted as our portion of his creation. Carrying on here, this is clip 16.
Tonight, let us dedicate ourselves to renewing the American compact. I ask you not simply to trust me, but to trust your values, our values, and to hold me responsible for living up to them.
Again, quite a different tone from what you heard last Thursday night, referring back to this compact, starting all the way back in Plymouth, 1620, saying that, look, don't trust me, but trust your values, and then hold me responsible to living up to those values, those traditions, those laws. It's quite a speech. It's quite a way to conclude. Notice this one, clip 17.
I have thought of something that's not a part of my speech and worried over whether I should do it. Can we doubt that only a divine providence placed this land, this island of freedom, here as a refuge for all those people in the world who yearn to breathe free?
Can we doubt this? That divine providence placed this land, this island of freedom here? He prefaces that by saying, I've thought of something that it's not part of my speech, and I'm worried about whether I should get into this or not. Notice further what he said. This is clip 18.
I'll confess that I've been a little afraid to suggest what I'm going to suggest. I'm more afraid not to. Can we begin our crusade? Join together in a moment of silent prayer. God bless America. Thank you.
And that's how the Republican convention, broadcast live on national television in the United States of America, that's how it ended just 36 years ago with Ronald Reagan veering away from his notes, confessing that he's a little afraid to suggest what he's about to suggest. That everyone there at that convention hall joined together in a moment of silent prayer, and by my clock here in the studio, it was 12 seconds of silence on national TV with Ronald Reagan bowing his head. Gerald Ford in the audience, the nominee from 1976, bowing his head in prayer. And then after that prayer, that silent prayer, God bless America. I suggest to you that there's some massive and very stark differences between the Republican nominee from 1980 and the one the Republicans have chosen today. And it gets back to God and humility and a man acknowledging that he alone is not able to do this or to fix this. It was going to take everyone banding together, renewing this compact, and looking to the great God, the divine providence that set up this island of freedom in the first place. Pretty amazing history. Well, as it happens, that man who became president in 1980, his wife met Herbert Armstrong, and then later, after Mr. Armstrong died, it was Ronald Reagan who sent this note to the Worldwide Church of God, saying that Mr. Armstrong contributed to sharing the word of the Lord with his community and with people throughout the nation. You can take pride in his legacy. Our prayers are with you. God bless you. Well, there's more here in my notes that I'd like to get into, but we are out of time. You're listening to Stephen Flurry, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on kpcg.fm. Send us emails. Send them to td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.